Welcome to Nerds at Church, a queer feminist podcast diving deep into faith, nerdery, and the Bible. I'm Pastor Emily, and I use pronouns like they, them, theirs.
And I'm Pastor Kay, and my pronouns are she, her. In this episode, we'll discuss our solar system.
Woohoo! It's finally here.
Yeah, I'm glad the solar system exists. Otherwise, you know, we wouldn't.
We might not exist.
Yeah, and this week, it's also our delight and joy to say thank you to all of our Patreon supporters. In order from our longest supporter to our most brand new supporter, we are delighted that you enjoy our show. And so shout-outs to Bridget Watley,
Pace Warfield,
Lowell Chilton,
Paul Bennett,
Pastor Eric L. Bodenstab,
Andrew Walker,
Sojin,
Elizabeth P. Y'all are awesome. If you want to become a Patreon supporter with them and get all the extra bonus content that we have, you can go to patreon.com/nerdsatchurch.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Check out the episode description for links to any references we make in this episode.
So today, our deep dive, as you might have guessed, is into our solar system. But we will, in fact, be staying on planet Earth the entire time.
I mean, I guess.
I mean, we're still in the solar system.
It's true. Our minds, though. No guarantees about our minds.
Oh, no.
They might be out in space. So, briefly, to locate ourselves, because as much as it feels like the concept of Earth or our solar system is massive, it's actually just a teeny tiny part of what is the entire cosmos. So, our solar system is located within the Laniakea supercluster, which is a group of a whole bunch of different galaxies. And within the Laniakea supercluster is the Virgo supercluster. Shout out to the Virgos out there.
Yay.
Which is a smaller supercluster within that bigger supercluster. And so the Virgo supercluster, the local group of galaxies. And then within that, our galaxy is the Milky Way galaxy, which is a barred spiral galaxy that is 26.8 plus or minus 1.1 kiloparsecs in diameter. So shout out to Star Wars and George Lucas's continual retconning that he knew that parsecs were distance and not time.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really, really wide diameter. And then it's only about 1,000 light years thick. And that's at the bulge of the spiral arms where it gets that thickness. And then within the Milky Way galaxy, our solar system is 27,000 light years from the galactic center. The galactic center is a supermassive black hole known as Sagittarius A. So
shout out to the Sagittariuses out there.
Woot woot, that's me. In case you didn't know what my sign was because you missed last week's, you can always go back and watch last week's episode on astrology. And then we are located on the inner edge of the Orion Arm or Orion Spur of the Milky Way galaxy.
Yeah.
In the Virgo supercluster, in Laniakea supercluster.
Now, of course, all of those names are Earth names that Earth people have given to all of these various clusters and objects and such. And so, as we hear in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, as the rest of the universe would know where our solar system is, they would say that it's far out in the uncharted backwaters of the unfashionable end of the western spiral arm of the galaxy in sector ZZ9 plural Z alpha. Thank you, Douglas Adams.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to, you know, the real universe that actually exists, or at least as far as we can tell, the solar system also orbits the center of the galaxy at about 515,000 miles per hour, taking about 230 million years to complete one orbit. And I personally am looking forward to the day when the aliens arrive and then as Americans we have to explain the imperial system of measurement to them and why we haven't switched to the metric system. But that's just me.
I mean, especially because, like, and we'll get into it more, right? But, like, when we talk about AUs, our astronomical units, what's an astronomical unit? The distance between Earth and the sun. Like,
yeah, no. Yeah. That's not going to work for anybody.
Imprecise at best. Yep.
Yeah, especially since the Earth and the sun are not always the same distance apart. By a fair bit, actually. Yeah. That's why we have seasons. Anyway, the word planet comes from an ancient Greek word which means wanderer. And in more ancient times than we currently live in, you might say, there were believed to be approximately 7 planets, including the sun and moon, but not counting Earth, because of course Earth wasn't a planet back then. Earth was just where we were walking around. And then, in the 16th century, they knew about five planets rotating around the sun plus Earth and the moon as the seventh going around the Earth. So we would say they knew about six planets plus the moon, you might say, to mm-hmm. translate. And these are the planets that are visible by the naked eye if you look at night without a telescope.
Yeah. But what I think is interesting about the 16th century one is that, so that's when they figured out that, and I think it was Copernicus, right? That the Earth rotated around.
Solar centric rather than Earth centric.
And then it kind of did count as a planet, but also the moon counted as a planet. Right. And so, yeah.
Yeah. And then in 1781, Uranus was discovered, the planet, that is.
Mm-hmm. And then between 1801 and 1807, they added Ceres, which is now categorized as a dwarf planet in the asteroid belt. They added Ceres and Pallas, Juno, and Vesta. All got mm-hmm. added in that time period. And then by 1851, they had added 15 more of the small objects, space objects, mm-hmm. in the asteroid belt. And at that time, they were called planets. And yeah. that was when they discovered Neptune. And then by the early 1900s, they had whittled it back down to eight planets. The asteroids, including Ceres, were demoted. And then in 1930, they discovered Pluto.
Yeah. And today, our solar system, according to NASA, who presumably would know, includes one star, eight planets, five dwarf planets, which in the order of the distance from the sun would be Ceres, Pluto, Haumea, Makemake, and Eris. At least 290 moons. We are still finding those. There are a lot of them. And more than 1.3 million asteroids. I imagine we'll keep finding those for a very long time. And about 3,900 comets that we know of so far.
Yeah. You know, just a few things.
Yeah.
So also, there's different mnemonic devices that we have created in our culture, particularly in English in the United States, to remember the order of the planets. And okay, I'm not sure how you learned the planets. I learned them with my very educated mother just served us 9 pizzas.
Yes, me too.
Yep. Which gets a little tricky nowadays. So I did a fair amount of reading of How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming by Mike Brown, who his name will pop up a few times in this episode. I am not done with the book yet because it's, you know, 400 pages long, but I have read a surprisingly large amount in the last like 36 hours. And he grew up with, for the mnemonic device, Martha visits every Monday and just stays until noon, period. Which I think is really interesting because there's an and in there that fits perfectly with asteroids.
Oh, nice.
And period is like this other thing, kind of like the sentence.
You can drop it.
Period.
If you want. Yeah.
And that was like before we had demoted Pluto or anything. So I just thought that that was an interesting way of doing the mnemonic device, and I actually really like that as a mnemonic device. So I think someday, if I am ever teaching young people mnemonic devices for the planets, that's the one that I will probably teach.
Yeah.
Yeah. And our days of the week are actually named after the planets. And, well, the understanding of planets that we had at the time. So we get Sun Day. So back when we thought about the sun as a planet, it's Sunday. And then Mercury is connected to the Germanic Grim Reaper or carrier of the dead, Woden, for Wednesday. So the easiest ones were Sunday, Monday, and Saturday, right? Because Monday, Moon Day, Saturday, Saturn Day. But the other ones were like other gods that were connected to these Roman gods who the planets are named after. So Mercury, Woden, Venus is connected to Friday because of Frigga, the Norse goddess of married love. And Mars is connected to Tuesday because of Tu, the ancient Germanic god of war. And Jupiter is connected to Thursday because of Thor, the Norse god of thunder.
Yeah.
So that was just like an interesting, huh?
Sure.
Okay.
So we are talking about the solar system today, but we are focusing on the planets rather than the sun. So obviously at the center of our solar system is the sun. Honestly, we could do a whole episode on the sun. We forgot to plan for that, so we're not this season.
But yeah, but we kind of touch on it in our next episode a little bit when we talk about astrophysics.
And also, if you really want us to do an episode on the sun, let us know through Blue Sky Facebook or various other social media aspects, and maybe we'll do it as a Patreon thing.
It's true. It's true. We could always dive into the sun.
But not literally, the dangerous way. Because we don't want to die. Yeah.
Yeah. We're not doing a sunshine.
Because even at nighttime, it's still very warm there. And so... As we dive into the rest of the solar system, let's start in the middle and work our way out. We'll start with the inner rocky and terrestrial planets, which begins with Mercury, which is the closest planet to the sun. It is visible in the early evening or early morning, and when you look for it in the sky, it is fairly small, so you do have to look pretty carefully. Mm-hmm. It is slightly larger than our moon. And there are a ton of craters on it, as we've been able to see through telescopes and such. Be very careful looking at Mercury through a telescope if you do, because again, it's very close to the sun. Don't burn your eyes. That would be bad. It has 88 Earth days in its year. That's how long it takes to do a full orbit of the sun. And it is named for the swiftest of the ancient Roman gods, Mercury, who was the messenger god.
Yeah, swift, because it spins around the sun so fast. And as we mentioned in our astrology episode, that's why it is in retrograde so much.
Yes.
The second planet from the sun is Venus. So it is closer to the sun than we are. And that makes it also visible in early evening or early morning, just like Mercury. So you have to be a little bit more careful when you're looking at it. It is the sixth largest planet. It's similar in size to Earth, and actually, like, sometimes gets referred to as Earth's twin, except that it is the hottest planet in the solar system. And this is because of the runaway greenhouse effect that turned Venus's surface water into vapor that then leaked into space, and also the thick atmosphere with the yellow clouds, and all of that just kind of like packs in the heat. So the rock surface on Venus is volcanic, and it spins backward from us. So it spins in the opposite direction that Earth spins, and a day is actually longer than a year on Venus, and there are no seasons on the planet. And it is named for the goddess of love.
Yeah. I believe if you're looking for Venus in the night sky, or you can actually sometimes see it in the daytime, it's actually pretty bright because of all that gas around it that reflects so much of the sunlight. And so Venus is usually a little easier to spot than Mercury is, from what I understand.
Yes. It is both closer and has a different type of reflective surface.
Yeah. And then, of course, there is Earth, which is also not appearing in this podcast episode.
I just realized that. I was like, we just skipped over Earth. It's true. And the two bodies that have been understood throughout history as the center of a universe, we just like skip over them. They got enough attention at that point.
Right. No, absolutely.
They're not also the center of the universe.
Again, so if you want us to do a special episode on Earth, that can be a Patreon thing. Let us know. And then, you know, join the Patreon.
Exactly.
There we go. It's not complicated.
Yeah. However, we are happy to do Patreon specials.
Yes. However, our moon is also known as Luna, when it means a name often, or occasionally Selene. And the moon has a mass equal to only 1.2% of the Earth's. The moon is essentially way, way more lightweight, way less mass. And it has a diameter about the width of Australia, which gives you an idea of how it compares in size.
I didn't realize it was that small.
Yeah.
It always feels bigger to
it's
me.
Pretty tiny. Well, and it is fairly close in terms of the solar system to our planet, but also it is fairly far away in terms of like going down the road to the chemist, as Douglas Adams would have put it. And so, yeah, it's an interesting size, but it's not that big compared to Earth. The gravitational pull of the moon, along with, to a certain extent, the sun, drives our tides of the oceans. And the moon also functions as a stabilizing force that makes Earth more pleasant as a place to live for life on Earth.
Which, like, P.S., Earth is, you know, the only known habitable planet or body in the solar system for now.
That we're so far aware of, yeah. And it is also larger than all of the known dwarf planets. And the longest human stay on the moon so far was about 75 hours by the Apollo 17 crew.
That's, you know, a while.
Yeah. No, that's more than 3 days.
Yeah. So go with Apollo 7.
Which we'll be talking about in our...
It's true.
Space Programs episode with Reverend Christian Rice.
Yeah. Episode 10. The next planet and the last full planet in what is considered the inner planets is Mars. Mars is dry, rocky, and bitter cold and has a red tint to it. All of the planets we've mentioned so far are visible to the naked eye if the lighting is right and you're looking in the right spot, sure. Right?
Can we talk about that red thing for just a moment? Because my understanding yes. is that Mars is known for its red tint. It looks red from Earth if you're looking into the sky. But my understanding is that the photos that we get from the Mars rovers and such, often when we see those photos, they have been slightly altered to look more red than they actually are. Because if you're taking a photo inside of Mars's atmosphere of the ground, it's not as red as we tend to think of Mars being. I believe it might be the atmosphere of Mars that adds to the red tint that we tend to think of. And so astronomers and people who study Mars who don't want the public to get angry with them have actually altered those photos somewhat to make them more red so that they don't have to have that conversation.
Interesting. The redness comes from the iron that has been oxidized, iron oxide.
Yes.
On Mars.
And my understanding is that if you're standing on the surface of Mars, it is still somewhat red. It's just not as red as most of the pictures we're used to seeing.
Yeah. Apparently, if you're on Mars, the sky looks kind of like pinkish orange.
Cool.
So says Cool Cosmos from Caltech.
Which might also add to the reddish tint that we would see from Earth, because we would be looking through the atmosphere, mm-hmm. So that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but that's like, when you're looking in the sky, if there's something that looks a little red, it's probably Mars, because mm-hmm. it's the only one that kind of looks like that. It is, according to NASA, the only planet we know of inhabited entirely by robots.
Aww. Who are all immigrants.
Yeah, who are all immigrants. Yeah, which is a fun way of saying that we have managed to land different probes on Mars, and they have and continue to roam around and collect information and pass it along to us. And yeah.
Sure.
So it is fascinating. It is 53% smaller than Earth, so about half the size of Earth, and the seventh largest planet. And Mars actually has two moons. The moons were discovered in 1877, so clearly before I was born. But we did not talk about Mars's moons in science class ever. So,
oh, I think we might have mentioned them in passing, but sure.
I don't think we really did. Like, Phobos and Deimos, like, they sound vaguely familiar, but I don't think we really talked about moons unless it was one of those, like, everybody picked a different planet and then you did a, like, report on it, and I did not pick Mars. I know that. I think I picked Uranus or Neptune. But Phobos is actually slowly being torn apart by Mars and or is on a collision course with Mars. It gets closer and closer to Mars every year. So who knows what will happen in the next, you know, few million years with that. And Deimos is smaller and is a kind of a small, lumpy, and heavily cratered moon. So at a greater distance from Mars.
Let's not body shame Deimos, but yeah.
I didn't say it wasn't lovely. I was just using descriptors.
Lumpy is just not usually a word that, and cratered for that matter. But anyway.
I mean, some of the planets, like when I was looking at this stuff for the moons for Jupiter and Saturn, there are some of them that this one's like a sweet potato. This one's like a regular potato. This one's like a ravioli. So I don't know.
And all that's of those NASA things are delicious. You, folks. But yeah.
Exactly.
But if you call somebody that on your first date, they're not going to be real thrilled. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Describe planets, not people.
I think that was a activity on Whose Line Is It Anyway? What can you say about blank that you can't say about your girlfriend? And planets would definitely, yeah, that would be one of those. Anyway.
Yeah. It's very gassy.
And so next out from the sun would be the asteroid belt, which includes, among billions upon billions probably of other objects, Ceres, Pallas, Juno, and Vesta. And Ceres was discovered by Giuseppe Piazzi in 1801, and he named it the eighth planet of the solar system at the time, but we've already discussed how it's not actually a planet now. I don't know if he would be as angry about that as many people are about Pluto now, but it seems like it's possible. And so shortly afterwards, the scientific element cerium was discovered and was named after Ceres, because Ceres had been discovered very recently. Ceres is the largest object in the asteroid belt and the only dwarf planet in the inner solar system. I assume that when we say it's the largest object in the asteroid belt, we're not including dark matter, but we'll get to that in a few episodes.
Yeah, that's next episode, yeah.
Yeah. And Ceres was classified as a dwarf planet in 2006 and was named for the Roman goddess of corn and harvest. The word cereal comes from that same name. Also in Greek mythology, she's known as Demeter. And then Pallas was discovered by Heinrich Olbers in 1802, very quickly afterwards, which at the time was named as the ninth planet. And shortly after that, the element palladium was discovered and named after Pallas. And I wonder when we manage to, you know, explore that a little closer, if it will have lots of little palaces all over it. Either the castle or the cats. I'm actually okay with either or both. Like lots of palace cats.
Of course you are.
Yeah. And then in 1804 was the discovery of Juno, which was at the time named as the 10th planet. And then 1807 was Vesta, and that was named as the 11th planet at the time.
And just a note, that was the point at which the chemists were like, we can't discover new elements fast enough. Sorry, we're done. We're done with you for a while.
Yeah. I assume that the goddess Juno is still angry about not having a element named after her, but that just seems like it would be in character for her. And so the word asteroid, which means star-like, which, you know, actual asteroids are basically rocks in space. So they're in space, but otherwise they're not really all that star-like, if I'm going to be picky about it.
They look star-like.
Yes, but the word itself was coined by William Herschel.
He discovered Uranus in 1781, and then all of these new quote-unquote planets were discovered. Ceres, Pallas, Juno, Vesta, the other, like, 15.
Sure.
And so the idea was, if he gave them a different classification, then Uranus would still be classified as a planet and, like, wouldn't get overrun by all of these other, like, planets.
Oh, sure.
That are different.
Does make sense. Sure. And 15 more were discovered within the asteroid belt by 1851, and this was the point at which they were removed from planet categorization because there were just too many of them in the same place. I'm going to choose to assume that this does not mean that the astronomers were bad at math and just didn't want to count that high, but you are free to assume whatever you like. And the asteroid belt possibly could have become a planet, as in the asteroids could have all merged together into one planet, essentially, if not for Jupiter's literally massive gravity, or also known as
Mavity, depending on where you are in Doctor Who.
Yes.
So the asteroid belt, pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
And every once in a while they, like, get flung at us or flung away or those sorts of things, too.
Hopefully not too close. That would be a problem.
Yeah, yeah. And then we get to the outer planets, which are the gas giants, Jupiter and Saturn, and the ice giants, Uranus and Neptune. And I, growing up, just knew of them all as gas giants. So I went really deep into NASA's website, because it's not obvious, in preparation for this episode, and it was delightful, and I was up way too late last night. Anyway.
That sounds wonderful. Also, I have to say that the whole gas giants versus ice giants thing makes them sound like, you know, monsters from Marvel comics. I don't know what the gas giants would look like, and I don't want to know either. But yeah.
Right? Yeah. So many options there. So Jupiter is the first of the gas giants. It is the largest planet in the solar system. It is more than twice as massive as all of the other planets combined. So we're talking huge. And if you look at pictures of Jupiter, you can see like bands of storms and clouds and atmosphere and stuff. And one red spot, though there's another red spot that's like starting to come into existence. And the red spot is actually a giant storm that has raged for hundreds of years. And I have actually seen it with my own eyes because I went to Moab when I was in Utah at one point, and we looked through a telescope late at night, and so we got to see Jupiter and the four Galilean moons, and then I was, like, looking at Jupiter, and I was like, there's, like, a thing? Is that, like, the red spot? And then the person that was leading it was like, yeah, it is! And I was like, yes!
Nice!
Glasses for the win!
Yeah.
Yeah.
The red spot has been visible for as long as we've had telescopes, basically.
Yeah.
As long as we've been able to see any kind of detail on Jupiter, we've been able to see the red
mm-hmm.
spot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Jupiter is another planet that you can see with your naked eye. So we've got a lot, but you can't see that much detail. Yeah. So the stripes and swirls are kind of cold, windy clouds of ammonia and water that are floating in an atmosphere of hydrogen and helium. And so that's kind of what Jupiter is comprised of. It is named for the king of ancient Roman gods. And Jupiter has 95, quote unquote, significant moon.
Now that's polyamory.
Yes, Jupiter is very polyamorous. Lots of significant moons. Which is to say that at a certain point, scientists decided, you know what? We cannot actually, like, name and classify and validate every single satellite, which is what a moon is, orbiting planets. They have to be significant. They have to be of a certain gravitas, or gravity, literally, in order to count. And so Jupiter is probably forever stuck at 95 moons. And the first moons that were ever discovered of Jupiter were discovered in 1610 by Galileo, and they are called affectionately the Galilean moons. So this was the first time, like, they're only visible via telescope, but they're visible via, like, pretty rudimentary telescopes. And they were also discovered by the German Simon Marius, but Marius did not publish his findings until after Galileo, so Galileo gets all the credit.
Yep.
The largest of those moons is Ganymede, and it is actually the largest moon in the solar system, and it is bigger than Mercury and Pluto. And the second largest is Callisto, and it is the third largest moon in the solar system. So Luna, I think, fits right between the two. So then Io is the third of the Galilean moons, and friend of the podcast, Stephanie, her favorite planetary body is Io, and she actually wrote a zine article on it that we'll link to with a whole bunch of really fun facts about Io. It is the most volcanically active world in the solar system. So if you want to, you know, take a trip and see volcanoes, that's where you go once we figure out very long distance space travel. And then Europa is the fourth of the Galilean moons. It's Jupiter's fourth largest moon. It is about 90% the size of Earth's moon. And there's actually the Europa Clipper is set to launch in October of this year to determine if this moon could possibly support life below its icy surface. So it has an icy surface, and then underneath they're trying to figure out what is possible under that. And most of the other smaller moons orbit farther out and are likely captured asteroids. And some of the smaller ones are maybe fragments from massive collisions and that sort of a thing. But Jupiter has a habit of catching asteroids. Some of them Jupiter flings right, you know, towards the sun / inner planets. And some of them Jupiter, like, catches into Jupiter's own orbit. And also, I will note, because my favorite now almost 4-year-old is very interested in the Lucy space probe, which is currently on its way to examine Jupiter's pockets, as she calls them. But those are the asteroids, because they collect things. So
yeah.
I just think that's adorable.
And the next planet out is Saturn, which is the second largest planet in the solar system. And of course, Saturn is primarily known for its rings, which are actually significantly newer in the planet's history than most of us think of. Saturn didn't always have those rings. The planet of Saturn is mostly made out of hydrogen and helium, and it is named for the Roman god of agriculture and wealth, and also the father of Jupiter. And it is the furthest planet that is still visible by the naked eye. Saturn has 146 moons. I'm guessing those are the significant ones, and there might be a handful of other ones that are less significant. Yeah. The largest is Titan, which is also larger than Mercury. And some of them are as small as a sports arena, which is still, like, pretty big. Like, I would not want Earth to get hit by one. That is kind of the way that I sort astronomical objects. Would the planet be destroyed if we got hit by this or not? And again,
I like that way a little of paranoid, sorting. I think
but
it's delightful.
But also it's centered on my safety, and therefore I think it's important. Yeah. And
fair.
Enceladus has a global ocean under a thick icy shell. And some of these moons are shaped like potatoes or ravioli, but I'm sure they're still lovely and possibly delicious. Who knows? And they interact with the rings around the planet and also the magnetosphere of the planet. Peggy is in the rings and may be forming or disintegrating or neither. We're kind of unsure on how that's working. We know that there's something going on, but we're unclear on exactly how that works. And other moons include Hyperion, Prometheus, Pandora, Janus, Epimetheus, Mimas, Epaetus, Phoebe, Tethys, Telesto, and several more. And some of the moons actually help shape the rings because of their gravitational pull.
Mm-hmm. Also, fun fact that I forgot to include, Saturn has a hexagon on its pole. It's the cloud pattern at the pole.
Huh. Okay.
And, like, it's located at about 78 degrees north, but we don't know why, we don't know what. It's fascinating.
Huh.
And it just kind of, like, spins around and, yeah.
Sure.
So, unexpected. Right? There's so much that we're like, we don't know why this is. We just know that it exists.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that takes us to all of the planets / objects that are visible without binoculars, telescopes, other assistive devices. And brings us to Uranus, which was discovered in 1781 by William Herschel, as we mentioned. And it is the seventh planet. And Uranium, which was discovered just 7 years later in 1788, is named after Uranus. And Uranus is visible by telescope. And it's kind of like a faint green color. And it is the third largest planet in the solar system. It is one of the ice giants. So it is cold and windy. And it has some faint rings. But Uranus rotates at nearly a 90 degree angle from the plane of orbit that the rest of us have. So it kind of, when we look at it and think about it, it appears to spin on its side. And the faint green color, the blue-green color, is from all of the methane in its atmosphere that absorbs the red and then kind of bounces back the blue and the green.
Mm-hmm.
And the atmosphere is mostly hydrogen and helium with large amounts of water, ammonia, and methane. And Uranus is named for the Greek god of the sky, who is father of Cronos or Saturn in Roman mythology. And Uranus has 27 moons. The five major moons are Miranda, Ariel, Umbriel, Titania, Oberon. And Uranus's moons are called the literary moons because they are all named for Shakespearean characters. And a couple are also named for characters from the works of Alexander Pope. But
yes.
Yeah. So we've got a literary planet right there.
Who was a poet and not the head of the Catholic Church. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, you'd be surprised how many people don't know that just because your name is Pope does not mean that you're the Pope. Yeah.
Yeah. I know enough people with the last name Bishop that...
That makes sense. Also, yeah. So, again, moving one planet further out in the solar system, we have Neptune, which was found by Johann Gall because of mathematical predictions by Urbain Le Verrier in 1846. And the element Neptunium was found shortly afterwards. This is the first planet located through mathematical calculations. Like, they took a look at the way things were moving in the sky, they did the math about the gravity, and they found it.
Also, Neptune is the first of the planets after the asteroid belt started to get discovered, and they named elements after Ceres and Pallas, and then they were like, nope, too many new planets, yes. We can't. But they did actually return to it with Neptune. It was kind of the restart of naming elements after planets.
Yeah, because that's significantly later. So they just took a little break in the middle.
Yeah.
And Neptune is dark, cold, and whipped around by supersonic winds. And the blue color of Neptune is also from methane in its atmosphere, absorbing the red wavelengths of light. It is named after the Roman god of the sea, who in Greece is also known as Poseidon. And Neptune has 14 moons. The largest is Triton, which was discovered only 17 days after the planet of Neptune was discovered and was found by William Lassell, amateur astronomer who used brewery business profit to buy telescopes. And of course, if you've heard the name Triton before, it might be because you've seen the Little Mermaid movie, because that's the dad's name. Yep. And it may have been captured from the Kuiper Belt at some point in the past. We're not really sure. We'll talk about the Kuiper Belt in a minute. And there are, of course, 13 other moons, which are named Despina, Galatea, Halimede, Hippocamp, Laomedeia, Larissa, Naiad, Nereid, Nesso, Proteus, Samanth, Sao, and Thalassa.
I love Neptune. Neptune's one of the ones that I really liked. I think Neptune is the one that I did a special whatever on in high school.
I definitely did a presentation on Uranus at one point in my college astronomy class, but sadly I have lost the PowerPoint for it. But I believe we mostly went with a Monty Python aesthetic for the presentation. Because we were going to make jokes, but we weren't going to make those jokes, you know?
I was going to say, Uranus is one of the ones that comes up the most in terms of references to it because of the easy jokes. Yeah. And then the next planet, the planet we've all been waiting for, especially those of you who filled out our Pluto poll, Pluto, for whom was named the element plutonium.
Pluto, for whom the bell tolls.
Yes. I was halfway into that sentence before I realized it was not. Yeah, so this is not the Disney character.
It is an exoplanet.
But is in fact, excuse you. We'll get there. And exoplanet is not an appropriate terminology for Pluto, says Emily. But we will tell you our opinions before we tell you the results of the poll. Don't worry. Anyway, Pluto was found in 1930 by Clyde Tombaugh. And Pluto has an elongated orbit that is also tilted 20 degrees away from the disk of the rest of the planets. So when you think about planets orbiting the sun, they're actually, like, for the most part, on an even plane that we orbit on. It's not like zigzaggy type things. We're all kind of lined up as a disk. I don't know why, but we are. And so Pluto being tilted 20 degrees is a big and weird thing. Like, that is a significant amount. I mean, even 8 degrees is a significant amount. So that's weird. And then it has an elongated orbit, so more of an oval than a circle. And none of the planets have exact circles because of the gravity of other planets and that sort of a thing. But to have that elongated of an orbit such that it is sometimes closer to the sun than Neptune is makes people a little wary. And in 2006, Pluto was reclassified by the scientists as a dwarf planet. And we all mourn because Pluto is wonderful, and when we had the New Horizons flyby and got pictures, Pluto has a heart, and that it's breaking. Like, actually, literally, the pictures, like, it's starting to break apart. And how do we know that's not because of the reclassification breaking Pluto's heart? I don't know. I'm just saying. It's a possibility, okay?
Except it doesn't look like a biological heart. It looks like a Valentine's Day decorative heart, which is not a culture that Pluto would be familiar with.
I mean, I don't know. Those are the kind that break. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I don't know that Pluto would be familiar with human biological hearts either, but
still. I know, because at most, dog hearts, right? Like,
obviously, yes.
Anyway, Pluto has 5 moons. Charon is the largest moon and makes Pluto wobble, which is another way to say that Charon is so big in relationship to Pluto that the center of gravity between the two is not as firmly in the center of Pluto as, like, with the Earth and our moon Luna, or other planets and their moon.
Yeah.
And Mark Showalter, who discovered 3 of the 5 moons, talks about the moons as forming a series of neatly nested orbits, kind of like the Russian nesting dolls. So 3 of the other moons are Nix, Kerberos, and Styx, which is the name of a 70s rock band. On NASA's website, they say, how many moons are named after a 1970s rock band? 1. Styx.
Except not really, because all of these moons are actually named after things from the Roman mythology.
It's true. It's true. They didn't say named after. They said sharing a name. Yeah.
Yes. Charon is the ferryman that brings you back and forth from the underworld. Pluto is the god of the underworld. Cerberus, or Kerberos, depending on which language you're talking about, is the 3-headed dog that guards the entrance to the underworld. Styx is the river that divides the underworld from the rest of the world.
Yeah. So that brings us, like, we have told you the facts, and we gave you a poll before we told you the facts. I am firmly hashtag Team Pluto. Which is to say, I respect science for the most part, and like aside from the like poking at biases that actually exist in science because humans do science, I am hashtag Team Pluto because a dwarf planet is still a planet. It's literally in the name. I actually really appreciate the way that they did the recategorization to have planets and dwarf planets and then small solar bodies, I think is the like sure. asteroids, comets and stuff. Okay, what is your very important professional opinion?
I totally agree with your reasoning about the dwarf planet thing still being a planet. I would, however, say that I am also on board with the concept of let's have a nostalgia planet category and Pluto can just be its own thing.
I would be in favor of that too.
Yeah, that I'm on board with that. That can be cool. Yeah.
Yeah. As we heard in last week's episode, the sky is very big. That's Emily Ann Garcia's opinion about Pluto.
The sky yes, which I believe big. Only appears in the Patreon episode. Sorry.
Okay. So,
again, join Patreon.
One of the things, yeah, and you get the questionable context of that.
Yes.
So, in our Pluto poll, which was very important, very official, very scientific, not at all. It was only on social media. It's fine. 22 people responded, which is like pretty good for us because I don't know if you all know, but you probably do. You don't engage and interact quite as much as like 22 is like a big deal because we don't hear back from you. So if you want to,
that's
like,
more interaction than we've ever gotten. Emails. You guys are great.
Yeah, that's what we're saying. Yeah, we love that you listen and we love when you engage and interact. So feel free to like share your opinion on Pluto after this and we Absolutely. Might even read them or definitely at least respond to them on a future episode perhaps. But the Pluto poll results are as follows. 45.5% of respondents said absolutely hashtag Team Pluto all the way. So just under half, but definitely the plurality. 18.2% said, no, it is not designated as a planet like the eight that count. And then 13.6% said, only if you also include Sharon, which I accidentally miswrote that option, but like, sweet, we can count them. They can be a binary planetary arrangement. Sure. It's fine.
The only true binary?
Yeah. And then we had 5 write-ins, because we gave everybody a write-in option because we are not heathens. And so those responses were only if you include Ceres, Pallas, Juno, and Vesta, which were the ones originally discovered before Neptune as part of the asteroid belt.
I think by that logic, we should also include the moon, I'm just saying.
I mean, the moon rotates around the Earth, though. I think that's part of it, is that
okay.
Ceres, Pallas, and Juno, and Vesta all rotate around the sun.
Sure. Maybe that's going more for anything bigger than Mercury, which is kind of fair.
It's possible. But then we would have a couple moons, I think Jupiter's moons, and maybe that would also count.
Yeah.
And then another write-in said, the rules are made up, the classification is arbitrary, so Pluto can be what your heart wants it to be. Also totally not a planet. That person's heart clearly says not a planet. And then another write-in was, no, the more we science, the more we change. That's reality. Everything else is wishful thinking. So very strict science person. And the next one was the science, TM. People tell me it isn't, but it makes the your very educated mother just served us 9 make less sense. To which I share Stephanie's advice of make it nachos. Your very educated yeah. mother just served us nacho. And that solves that problem. However, it's debatable of if you want that problem solved, actually.
Yeah.
And then the final write-in was, yes, and we should include Charon. Though Pluto's planethood is not conditional based on Charon or other dwarf planets in our solar system yet to be discovered. So
I think the not making it conditional part, that part also makes sense. I'm on board with that.
Yeah, I think the argument around Ceres, Pallas, Juno, and Vesta is that they are named after goddesses, and so many of the planets are named after gods, and the ones that get kicked out are
evening it
the
up.
Goddess ones, sure. and then Pluto says, and so that's a little bit of it, and also, like, size-wise, but
yeah.
the asteroid belt ones got, officially at least, kicked out because there are too many of them in the same space. Which is interesting because, and we kind of talked about this at the beginning of the history of how we classified things as planets, right? Planets are wanderers. Pluto will always be a wanderer in our sky. And so in that sense,
sure.
Pluto will always be a planet. but also, like, we haven't always defined planets as anything more than a wanderer in a sky, a body in our solar system that is not the sun or our moon, right? Like, so we haven't had very clear definitions of planet. And then as we've discovered more things, we've started to categorize more specifically and more strategically around what is a planet, what is a comet, what is an asteroid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Pluto does not actually finish this episode for us, because next we have the Kuiper Belt, which is an additional part of our solar system. Mm-hmm. And the Kuiper Belt is a huge region of space, which is beyond Neptune. And if you want to think about what it looks like from the outside, it's sort of shaped like a puffed up disc or a donut. Like, think of our solar system from Neptune inwards is the center of the donut, where the hole is in the donut. And then the Kuiper Belt is outside of that. And the outside edge of the donut is way past everything else, basically. It's enormous. And it has some similarities with the main asteroid belt. There's a lot of stuff in there, basically. It possibly also, much like the asteroid belt, could have become a planet if not for Neptune's gravitational pull, which keeps all the smaller stuff from coming together, because Neptune basically just keeps stirring the pot, you might say. There are more than 2,000 Kuiper Belt objects that have been cataloged, but there are probably at least hundreds of thousands of them, and it's gonna be a while before we manage to find them all. We need some better abilities to see out that far, basically. And the Kuiper Belt is slowly eroding itself away and has gone from being about 7 to 10 times the mass of the Earth in terms of the amount of stuff that's in there to only being 10% of the mass of the Earth already. Mm-hmm. So that took a while. Like, that wasn't, you know, just in the last couple hundred years. But yeah, still, that's a big change. Pluto, Eris, Haumea, Quarar, and Makemake are Kuiper Belt objects that have moons. Haumea is about the size of Pluto, but it is a very oval shape to it, instead of being more circular that we tend to think of as planets, because of its extremely fast rotation. It rotates once every 4 hours. It was discovered about 2003-2004, and it was named after the Hawaiian goddess of fertility. Haumea has two moons, Namaka, which is the inner moon, and Haiaka, which is the outer moon, and they were discovered in 2005, and they were named for the daughters of Haumea. Haiaka is the patron goddess of the island of Hawaii and of hula dancers, and Namaka is a water spirit in Hawaiian mythology. And Haumea is also the first known Kuiper Belt object to have rings, which were discovered in 2017. Makemake's discovery, along with Eris, prompted the International Astronomical Union. That's the International Astronomical Union, not the International Astrological Union that we talked about last episode.
Yeah. I know, when I saw that, I was like, oh my gosh. That's going to be confusing for people at all.
But that prompted the IAU to reconsider the definition of a planet and to create the category of dwarf planets. And this is named after the Rapa Nui god of fertility. Eris was originally thought to be bigger than Pluto, actually, prompting the reclassification and new categorization of dwarf planets. It was originally discovered in 2005 from data that had been obtained in 2003 from Mike Brown and Chad Trujillo and David Rabinowitz. It was originally nicknamed Xena and called the 10th planet, with a tiny moon that was nicknamed Gabriella because these folks had watched Xena, Warrior Princess, and wanted to name the moon after Xena's sidekick / partner. Gabrielle was pretty awesome. It was renamed by the IAU with classification as a dwarf planet, and was then named after the Greek goddess of discord, and the moon Dysnomia after the demon goddess of lawlessness, the daughter of Eris. And then we have Quarar, which is also known as 50,000 Quarar, is a ringed dwarf planet with one moon, known as Weiwat, and it was first observed in 2002, and the moon was first observed in 2007 by Mike Brown and Chad Trujillo again. And this was named after the genderless creation force of the universe of the Tongva tribe. And the Kuiper Belt is one of the places that comets come from, which are pushed into an orbit toward the sun by Neptune, and then Jupiter sort of sends them into these short loops around and around. and it was named for Kuiper, but he had just speculated on objects beyond Pluto back in 1951 and didn't actually like find it himself. And the second object of the Kuiper Belt was not found until 1992, so this is super recent.
Yeah, yep. And then you think we're done, but we're not. There's more. Even out beyond the Kuiper Belt is the Oort cloud. So it is even more distant than the Kuiper Belt, and it is spherical rather than disc-like. So instead of a donut, it basically wraps the whole solar system up in a beautiful ball of stuff.
Sure.
It is a region of icy comet-like bodies that surrounds the solar system, and most of our long-period comets that are on highly tilted orbits originate here. So we talked about Pluto at a 20-degree orbit. The comets that come in that are at all sorts of orbits come from, likely, the Oort cloud. And the closest edge of the Oort cloud is up to 100 times as far away from the sun as Pluto is from the sun at the distant end of Pluto's orbit. So
wow,
that's like a lot. And Pluto is like 500 times as far away.
Yeah.
As Earth. So, and then technically the Oort cloud has been unobserved and is therefore theoretical. So there hasn't been any direct observation yet of the Oort cloud.
Yeah. Sure.
So a lot of this comes from NASA's website. So if you are curious, they have really great, really accessible website for learning about all sorts of things about our solar system. And so the whole thing with the like significant moons versus insignificant moons, scientists have gotten very good over time at spotting tiny moons orbiting distant giant planets. So many tiny moons have been found that the International Astronomical Union, which governs official names of planets and moons, will no longer name the smallest moons unless they're of quote-unquote significant scientific interest. There are likely thousands more moons awaiting discovery in our solar system, whether or not they receive name. And then another question that I think is just an interesting one to ask is, how far have spacecraft gone? So we know that the Parker space probe is currently circling the sun and is the closest to the sun that we've ever gotten a space probe, but the farthest out is a different question. So Voyager 1 made it out of the solar system in 2012, and Voyager 2 was not far behind it in 2018. They were launched in 1977, and they are both still in communication with Earth. So we're still receiving data and news from them, albeit a bit slowly. And then New Horizons, which showed us Pluto's heart, is kind of the next one out there, and it is currently exploring the Kuiper Belt. So it is still active and doing its mission stuff. Eventually it will leave the Kuiper Belt, but that has not happened yet. And then Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11 are older spacecraft, and they will ultimately travel silently among the stars, vaguely toward the galactic core, but their power supplies were used up decades ago, so we're not hearing from them at all.
Yeah.
So they're just out on their own.
Yeah, I hope so. And so what about our solar system in pop culture, Emily? We are nerds at church, after all.
We are indeed. So one of the ways that our solar system comes up is in the show Foundation. I have not read the books.
There are 5 books, the original trilogy plus 2.
Okay. I have not read the books, but in the second season of Foundation, the origin story of our solar system and of kind of the whole everything is depicted on one of the walls, and that includes only 8 planets. So sorry, Pluto.
Which is interesting because the books are definitely not set in our solar system.
Yeah, it's not that it's set in the solar system. There's like a myth or something.
Oh, sure. Okay.
That has to do with our solar system.
Yeah, that tracks. And then also Gustav Holst, a composer, wrote a 7-movement orchestral suite during World War I. It wasn't inspired by World War I. That was just when he happened to be writing it, as far as I can tell. And it was called The Planets, where each of the 8 planets known at that point, except for Earth, gets a movement. So he gave one to all the other 7 planets. And in the book Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein, when the main character who was born on Mars and is essentially claiming to be the sovereign monarch of Mars for various planets plot reasons I won't go into at the time. He needs a musical theme to play while his flag is presented at a diplomatic event. And so they use the Mars movement from this orchestral suite for it. And it actually works very well for his purposes because it is like super percussion-y and enthusiastic and very actually martial. And so it kind of freaks people out a little bit, which is what he was going for.
Yeah. Also, fun fact, you can listen to the planets. I forgot about this until just now. There's actually, like, NASA scientists found a way to listen to the sounds of planets in our solar system. So that's, like, different spacecraft and machinery and technology can capture different wavelengths and then convert them into sounds in ranges that we can hear. So we'll try to find that because I remember listening to it and it was just like really interesting.
And for that matter, the orchestral suite by Gustav Holst is also now in public domain. And so I would imagine you can listen to that any number of places online.
Yeah, nice. And then in the TV series, The Expanse, which has come up a few times in the course of our podcast, is set in our solar system. So Ceres, which we've mentioned, is inhabited by humans. Over the generations, they've adapted to life without as much gravity. And that actually comes to play in the series The Expanse. Mm-hmm. Also, Mars is inhabited and very militaristic in The Expanse. The moon is inhabited, and the moon and Earth kind of function as one nation. And there's a ring that is created at one point that transports folks to other planetary systems. And that is located 2 AU, or astronomical units, outside of Uranus. And a reminder that an astronomical unit is the distance between the sun and the Earth. Who knows when? We're not sure. But again, it's not a perfect circular orbit. But yeah.
Yeah. And then there's the movie Apollo 13, which is about the difficult space mission of the Apollo 13 mission and the many things that went wrong during that mission. And I tend to think of this as also known as why astronauts have to also be scientists, because you see why in that movie and in the story.
Yeah. And then, as we've mentioned before, Battlestar Galactica, the majority of the show actually takes place looking for our solar system, which eventually they do find.
Yeah. Babylon 5 is a TV show from the 90s that actually was unusual for science fiction because it included our solar system as part of the science fiction exploration, much like Star Trek does, but surprisingly few other science fiction fictional universes do. And so one of the characters, Michael Garibaldi, has a whole plot line set on Mars, basically for his character during one of those seasons. Mars at the time is basically run by a giant corporation, and let's just say late stage capitalism is in effect. And his ex-wife, who he's still in love with, is married to the CEO, and that gets awfully complicated. So,
Ooh, yeah. Also, Interstellar, which actually a lot of it takes place outside of our solar system, but it starts and ends within our solar system, and many people are alive and in our solar system throughout. And it starts on Earth and ends, I believe, in orbit around Jupiter.
Yeah, The Martian is a book about a astronaut who gets accidentally left behind on Mars and then has to keep himself alive for long enough to get rescued. It is a impressively fast read and a great example of why, if I'm ever going into space, I want to go with professionals who actually know what they're doing. Dang it. Like, that's not paranoia. That's just common sense. So.
It's true. It's true. And I really liked the movie too.
I have heard great things. I have not seen it. Yeah.
And of course, Doctor Who. How do we talk about it without talking about the fact that it does frequently take place in our solar system?
Yeah.
And in fact, even though Neptune is the farthest planet from our sun, it is a frequent stop in pop culture fiction. And so that's where one of the Doctor Who episodes from the 12th Doctor, Capaldi, and Clara Oswald as Jenna Coleman, the episode Sleep No More, takes place actually on a space station orbiting Neptune.
Yeah. And I believe Clara and Capaldi also had a episode that was set in part on the moon, which was then discovered to be an egg of a giant astronomical creature that they were unclear on how that worked.
Yes, that sounds right. And there have been quite a few
Sure.
episodes involving moons and the beginning of Christopher Eccleston and Rose Tyler.
Sure.
Has to do with like the end of Earth. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then there's also the book The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, which is set, as you might imagine, on the moon, which is by Robert Heinlein. And that is essentially a guide on how to organize either a rebellion or a strike or both, depending on how you think of it, because of the complicated political situation while on the moon. And it goes into quite a few of the specific nitty-gritty adaptations that humans had to make in order to live on them, which was super interesting. Mm-hmm. I have a real appreciation for early science fiction's focus on the nitty-gritty aspects of how does this actually work.
Yeah. And then what was really interesting to me as I was like investigating and looking up information on all of the planets on the NASA website is that NASA even has like, here's where some of these planets show up in pop culture. So we'll also add a couple of theirs. And
yeah,
thank you, NASA, so much for so much of this episode.
We love you, NASA. So for Jupiter in pop culture, they would tell us that the biggest planet in our solar system has a large presence in pop culture, including many movies, TV shows, video games, and comics. Jupiter and its moons were notable destinations in the Expanse series, while various Jovian moons provide settings for Cloud Atlas, Futurama, Power Rangers, and Halo, among many others. In the movie Men in Black, when Agent J, played by Will Smith, mentions he thought one of his childhood teachers was from Venus, Agent K, played by Tommy Lee Jones, replies that she is actually from one of Jupiter's moons. Outside of NASA, I would just like to personally point out that they did miss Jupiter Ascending, and part of that movie happens on a station just inside the red spot on Jupiter.
Mm, yeah. And then in Neptune, we already mentioned the Doctor Who episode, but also Neptune served as the backdrop for the 1997 science fiction horror film Event Horizon. And in the cartoon series Futurama, the character Robot Santa Claus has his home base on Neptune's North Pole.
And then Uranus is the source of, as NASA would tell us, more than a few jokes and witty or not so witty puns. The ice giant also has been a destination for fictional stories and on TV shows such as Doctor Who. The radioactive element uranium was named after Uranus when it was discovered in 1789, just 8 years after the planet was discovered. Thank you, NASA.
Indeed. Thank you so much, NASA. And so we come to the time where we're like, okay, we learned lots of stuff, but what does it have to do with the Bible? Well, lots. First off, it is, in fact, hard to find planets in the Bible, because a lot of times they're like, different cultures have understood planets to be deities. But if we're taking the original definition and interpretation of the word planet, it is a wanderer, and those are everywhere in the Bible. We're actually not going to talk about those, but I just thought that that was an interesting, like, okay, we don't think that planets are in the Bible, but there are wanderers all over the Bible. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Our first reading is from Genesis chapter 1, and you can include verses 14 to 15, but we're mostly looking at verses 16 through 19. We keep coming back to Genesis because it is so rich when it comes to the exploration of outer space. And so in Genesis 1, we read of God creating sun, moon, stars, and presumably planets.
Yeah. So if you remember the bit about celestial spheres and Aristotle from our cosmology episode earlier this season, the first episode of the season, when we read the phrase in verse 17, God set the moon in the dome of the sky, that seems to be a hint of just how popular that theory was and for how long. If you're calling the sky a dome, that it seems to be related. However, in verse 18, we have that whole separate the light from the darkness thing. And I've got to tell you, God, that didn't work out too well. Like, there's a lot of places where those mix.
That is true. The gift of mirrors and complicated language.
Yeah.
I just love the, like, and the stars, right? Where it's like, God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. And there's just like this, okay, like,
right,
they wrote the whole thing and then they're like, oh, wait, the stars. We got to throw them in somewhere. And nice. The stars. Mm-hmm. And then our other reading for this episode is Matthew chapter 24, verses 29 through 31. In this, Jesus describes the coming of the human one, or son of humanity.
And in verse 29, we read that the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. And I don't know that it occurred to me before, but I think this might be the description of an eclipse. It sounds like an eclipse to me, like the moon does not give light during an eclipse because it's literally dark because the sun is on the other side. And so the sun is dark too.
Yeah, which speaking of, there's an eclipse coming up. So let us know if you're going to go try and see the eclipse this year.
Sure.
I was looking at it and I didn't notice the eclipse part as much, but then the stars will fall from heaven. I was like,
sure.
So is this just like a meteor shower?
Yeah.
Because that's how we experience meteor showers. Shooting stars, falling stars, all of them get categorized as like meteors.
Yes. Yeah, I have to admit, every time someone brings up a meteor shower or shooting stars, I always immediately flash back to my most memorable stolen Christmas Eve children's sermon ever, where I was trying to talk about how during Silent Night with our candles, we were going to look like the night sky and every candle would look like a star. And the important thing about stars is that they twinkle, but they don't move. So don't move your candle. And I was trying to be helpful to the parents of the small children who were listening to the children's sermon. And immediately the grandchild of, set of folks, the grandchild was visiting, I was not familiar with her, piped up and said, but what about shooting stars? Shooting stars move. And the entire congregation just lost it. I don't think I had control over that service for the rest of the night. Like, that was just, it was gone. That was amazing. Yep. Also, if that kid happens to be listening to this right now, that was amazing, and I loved it. And also, it taught me a lot about what not to say during a children's sermon, so thank you.
That's real. That's real. Uh-huh. A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
I mean, it's happening now, and it's as close as your podcast provider, so...
Two queer, trans, non-binary podcast co-hosts set out to cover the most amazing franchise of all time.
I mean, is it the most amazing, though? We've already covered so many great ones, like A Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, Twilight, Ghostbusters.
First off, Twilight was not amazing, even if our episodes about it were. Secondly, Star Wars is the most amazing because it has droids and Leia and sci-fi and action and R2-D2 and BB-8.
Okay. It's up there. I'll give that to you. That's not for debate. But we're not just covering Star Wars this season. We're also covering the Alien franchise, which is also amazing because it has Ripley and sci-fi and aliens and horror and...
Details. I'm Pastor Emily, and I am the droid in the background. Never noticed? Never wiped of memory, always watching.
That's a little creepy. And I'm Pace Warfield, and I am the awesome yellow loading machine that Ripley uses in the Alien franchise to beat up things.
Totally. And we're the hosts of Horror Nerds at Church, a ridiculously queer podcast with a horror Padawan.
And a horror nerd buff, all the things. Horror master.
There we go.
Each season we follow a horror franchise or horror adjacent and a host of other horror and horror adjacent movies to talk about how they connect to queerness, religion, and theology.
We feature bona fide scary movies like Halloween, The Witch, Candyman, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Suspiria.
But we've also covered non-scary movies or low-stakes horror movies like Ghostbusters, The Addams Family, Doctor Strange, Hocus Pocus.
Our upcoming season, we are covering a galaxy far, far away by looking at the Star Wars and Alien franchises from queer, religious, and horror perspectives.
Tune in this season because we talk about whether or not all droids go to heaven.
They absolutely do.
Whether the Jedi are cops or religious movement.
They're both.
And whether or not Han Solo shot first.
He definitely did. We also dive into the Trinitarian aspects of all things Force, look at the false binary of light and darkness, especially as it relates to the Force, examine Star Wars from a horror perspective, and interview amazing guests like Claudia Gray, author of many Star Wars novels, horror author Ben Monroe, who interned at Lucasfilms, and many more.
And for you true blue horror fans like me, don't worry. We're also covering the Alien franchise and looking at how that franchise might be one of the greatest slasher franchises of all time. The weird and convoluted theology of the movie Prometheus, and how much of an amazing character Ripley is.
Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you catch your podcasts.
And now for our Muppets moment. So, Emily, if the Muppets did a musical called Our Solar System, which song would be your favorite?
I would probably have to go with a song like Pluto, We Miss You, You Are Our Friend, something like that. Pluto, We Miss
Excellent.
You.
Excellent. Sure. Pluto, We Miss You sounds like a great song title, too. Yep.
Right? That's what I went with, and then I just was like, and my voice will make sounds.
Sure. And the rest of it. I immediately thought of, I could totally see the Muppets having great fun jumping through the clouds on Jupiter. And so I think Jumping on Jupiter would be the song title. And then there would be a whole bit of the Muppets running around in the clouds on Jupiter and probably having a little trouble getting through the red spot. I think Animal would especially have a great time with that.
I love that. Also that it totally ignores the gravity reality that they would like get sink squished. And fly.
Yes, but we know the Muppets. They're not going to do that. But if they have to have jetpacks, that's fine. But yeah.
I love it. I love it. I was like, when you started talking about like jumping on Jupiter, I was like, I mean the asteroid belt too. Like you could just do like space hopping.
Oh, hopping from one
have
to
a
next.
Like sure. Space hopping one that's just like background one. So you get like the asteroid belt, the Kuiper belt, the Oort cloud, but like they're just space hopping. And so you have that as sure. Like your transitional music.
And the hops yeah. would be much, much longer in the Kuiper belt and the Oort cloud than they are in the asteroid belt.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I love the names of our songs. If any of our listeners want to like make up songs with these titles or your own song, let us know because this would be hilarious. I'm here for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, dear listeners, for joining us. Our theme music was by Rachel Meyer Lachlan. Our Muppets music was by Brenda Boss, and our seasonal artwork was by Pace Warfield. Catch us next time when we'll dive into astrophysics with our special guest, Dr. Katie Mack. This podcast has been produced by us, Emily Ewing and Kay Roloff. For more fun, check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and Blue Sky at Nerds at Church, or contact us at nerdsatchurch@gmail.com.
Also, if you like what you've heard, rate us or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Facebook, or wherever you catch your podcasts. If you want access to our uncut episodes, merch discounts, movie commentaries, and more, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nerdsatchurch. Starting at just $5 per month, it's cheaper than buying yourself a planet, which if you want to explore that possibility, try John M. Ford's novel set in the original series of Star Trek universe called How Much for Just the Planet, which manages to be a musical in novel form. And it's hilarious.
Ooh, nice. That sounds fantastic. Also, yes. Let us know on Blue Sky, Facebook, or Twitter, which song would be your favorite in the Muppets musical, Our Solar System.
As the ancient Christians said,
Pax vobiscum.